This is the 2011 Rocky Mountains Bible School, Day 3, Class 2. Our speaker is Brother Mark Vincent from the Boston, Massachusetts Ecclesia. His theme for the week is the Enigma of Ecclesiastes, and his class title for today is God and Time.
Well, good morning, everybody. We're actually not going to talk about God and time today, so I've got you here under false pretenses, so sorry about that. There's a whole lot more to say about death. Always an encouraging topic. So we're going to stick with death today, and we're heading towards Ecclesiastes 12. Do you remember how yesterday we stepped inside the frame, didn't we, from the front end, and we looked at that poem in Ecclesiastes 1 about all those different cycles and how they mock our frailty and the temporary nature of our existence, such a short span of time. And yet, all our experience is derivative and repetitive. There's nothing new under the sun. So the book starts with death, or the words of the preacher start with death, and they're going to end with death when we get to chapter 12. But on the way there, I want us to look at a couple of other passages. Now, we're not going to have time to get through all the material this week that we might have wanted to, so you've got a choice tomorrow. So we're going to have a quick show of hands now. So we can either talk about God and time tomorrow, amongst other things, which is about Ecclesiastes 3, and time and chance and all that. Or we can talk about the great experiment of Solomon described in chapters 1 and 2 of Ecclesiastes. So can I have votes for God and time? And votes for the great experiment of chapters 1 and 2? Well, it's pretty close, but I think God and time wins. So we'll try and program that for tomorrow. Let's begin in chapter 3. Towards the end of chapter 3. And we'll come in at verse 18. I said in mine heart concerning the estate of the sons of men, that God might manifest them, and that they might see that they themselves are beasts. Now, I remember Brother David Levin saying something about this that has stuck in my mind ever since. I'm not sure whether it was his quote or whether he was quoting somebody else. But he talked about human beings as caught between the image of God and the fate of beasts. And that just captures our position in a very powerful way, doesn't it? The image of God, on the one hand, so much more than the animals. You know, they're put under our dominion. We have the moral, intellectual, spiritual, aesthetic, artistic, emotional capabilities, linguistic capabilities that go far beyond anything that's been discovered in any of the other creation. We're in the image of God, and yet we are but beasts, like sheep. They are laid in the grave. And doesn't that just seem so wrong? Doesn't that just seem such a contradiction? How come we can be so much better in these ways, so much more capable, with so much greater capacities, and yet we meet the same end as they? It's just not right, is it? And this is exactly the sort of contradiction that the preacher loves to indulge in. Well, he probably hates to indulge in it, but he finds himself forced to indulge in it because that's who we are. We're caught in the midst of that contradiction, aren't we? It's the very essence of our nature. And it's our hope, and it's our duty to share that hope, that we might be more than the beasts that we often are. And, you know, we see society around us often choosing the lowest common denominator, don't we? And choosing to be nothing more than beast, and choosing to follow, you know, just natural animalistic sort of urges to live like animals and to die like animals. And God has offered us the opportunity to exercise the spiritual man and to look forward in hope to a day when that potential that there is within us is fully unlocked and we can live and give God glory in a way that will be so much more full than the way in which we can now. But for the time being, in Ecclesiastes chapter 3, Solomon, or the preacher, is concentrating on that beastly aspect of our existence, that we are, because of death, just like the beasts. And did you notice what it says there? And this is something that we'll be picking up and enlarging on much more later on in the week. I said in my heart concerning the estate of the sons of men that God might manifest them. So this is something that God wants to show us. God wants us to take a look at this and to see the awfulness of it. The awfulness of the fact that we should die like the animals, though we share in some sense still the image of God. That they themselves might see that they themselves are beasts. And again, it's only when we see that, when we hit the bottom, that we have a chance of redeeming ourselves. For that which befalleth the sons of men befalleth beasts, even one thing befalleth them, as the one dieth, so dieth the other. Yea, they have all one breath, so that a man hath no preeminence above a beast, for all is vanity. All go into one place, all are of the dust, and all turn to the dust again. And that's, you know, that is exactly Genesis 3, isn't it? This is the punishment that God imposed upon man. So it's true, isn't it? He's right. He's looking it right in the face and telling it how it is. This is the preacher, the realist. As the one dieth, so dieth the other. Yea, they have all one breath. And elsewhere, so here he's saying, we all die. Death is the great leveler, isn't it? It's the end of everything and everyone, and it mocks us in the way that we talked about yesterday. And it doesn't just make men like beasts; it makes good men like bad men. Like beasts, doesn't it, as well? And that's not something that he's going to explore in this passage, but he explores that in other passages that we won't be looking at, probably. But, you know, this concept of everyone dies the same death. I mean, there might be some deaths that are more painful than others, but they're all deaths, aren't they? And, you know, Hitler dies in the same way that someone that, you know, the world might look on as a good person. And, you know what I mean by that, not in the sense in which Jesus uses it, but someone who's done a lot of good works for society, they're going to die just like Hitler dies, aren't they? And that's one of the sorts of contradictions, one of the absurdities, one of the meaningless things that he's going to point out elsewhere in the book. But let's carry on now into verse 21. Now, this is interesting, isn't it? Because this is one of those passages that sometimes get pushed at us, don't they? Who knoweth the spirit of man that goeth upward, and the spirit of the beast that goeth downward to the earth? So this is a rest of scripture, isn't it? But all we've got to do here is look at the context, because he's just... If he really meant this, you know, if this is something that he was saying seriously, that the spirit of a man goes up and the spirit of a beast goes down, then he would be completely contradicting what he just said in the previous verse. Now, there are contradictions in Ecclesiastes, but they're not that type. You know, they're not sort of stupid contradictions. They're clever contradictions, and they're intelligent and powerful ones that make a point. So he's just said in verse 20, all go to one place, all are of the dust, and all turn to the dust again. And what he's doing in verse 21, then he's not citing a literal fact. It's a kind of rhetorical question. So someone's going to claim that it's not like that, are they? So someone's gonna claim that the spirit of a man goes up and that the spirit of a beast goes down. Well, where's your proof for that? You have absolutely no evidence for saying that whatsoever. That's just pure speculation, which is completely baseless. That, I think, is the sense of verse 21. He's just said definitively, all go to one place, and who knows, you know, And if anyone wants to claim any different, well, who knows if that's true? Where's the evidence for that? There isn't any. It's just a nice thought, if it is that. So I think that's the way in which verse 21 is to be taken. So there's one of the clear passages about death from the book. So it must be better to be alive then, mustn't it, than to be dead? You know, it's pretty miserable having this fate of beasts, but you know, we've all got that coming to us. But well, at least we're alive at the moment, so that's something, isn't it? Well, actually, no, it's not. Let's have a look at chapter 9. I just love the irony in this passage. Chapter 9 and verse 2. All things come alike to all. There is one event to the righteous and to the wicked, to the good and to the clean and to the unclean, to him that sacrificeth and to him that sacrificeth not. As is the good, so is the sinner, and he that sweareth, as he that feareth an oath. So this was getting back to my point that I was making before about people die the same death. You know, the people live good lives and they die, and people live, again, just thinking about life in the here and now, life in this on this earth as it is, as an end in itself, not thinking about the ultimate hope in the kingdom, not thinking about the resurrection to judgment of the responsible, but thinking about those who just live their lives and die, and what reward there is within the confines of this life. This is an issue, isn't it? You know, it seems a vanity. It is a vanity that someone who has made a real effort and done all kinds of good works dies like someone who has been a despot and has done terrible, terrible crimes of genocide and other types of cruelties that are carried out in this world. And that is one of the vanities of this life. That is one of the vanities that God has subjected the creation to. It's one of the discontinuities, one of the incongruities of this life that tells us there must be another life coming in God's kingdom when things will be different. It's not about this life. Verse 3, this is an evil among all things that are done under the sun, that there is one event unto all. Yea, also the heart of the sons of man is full of evil, and madness is in their heart while they live, and after that they go to the dead. Great. So they do all this crazy stuff while they're alive, and then they die. And that is choosing the way of a beast, isn't it? Only what we do is more crazy than what the beasts do very often. Now then, it's verse 4, really, that is the reason why we've come to this passage. For to him that is joined to the living, there is hope. For a living dog is better than a dead lion. So, and what you might be doing here is quoting, you know, like quoting a proverb. A living dog is better than a dead lion. And, you know, it's sort of a bit like a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush, isn't it? One of the sort of things that people say, and you sort of nod your head and say, well, that's true, yeah. A living dog is better than a dead lion. At least it's alive. And then Solomon sort of agrees with that, but he does so in a very ironic way. For the living know that they shall die, but the dead know not anything. So it's much better to be alive then, isn't it? Because at least when you're alive, you know you're going to die. And that is his point. Don't you just love it? It just fills you with the enthusiasm and the joy of joie de vivre, isn't it? This. For the living know that they shall die, but the dead know not anything, neither have they any more reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. So, more about death, but at least when you're living, you know you're going to die. So that's one way in which it's better to be alive than to be dead, but there are other ways in which it's better to be dead than to be alive. Now, we don't normally think of that, do we? But the preacher does. And let's have a look at two of those passages. One is in chapter 7. A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of one's birth. Now, the first part of that is quite nice, isn't it? A good name is better than precious ointment. So which would you rather have? Would you rather have a good name, that people respect you and honor you, or would you rather smell nice? Well, you know, probably, I mean, we'd like to hear it, or I'd say both, please. But if it's an either or, I'd probably rather have the reputation, have the good name. I don't know if it's possible to have a good reputation and a good name when you don't smell nice, but but let's imagine that theoretically it was. But you can see that a good name is better than precious ointment is one of those things that, you know, that might well have occurred in Proverbs, that verse, mightn't it? A bit like a living dog is better than a dead lion. You know, it's a sort of little quotable expression, a little proverb that, you know, you think about it and think, yeah, I can see. To have a good reputation, to be held in esteem by others, is not a light thing. That's something that's really valuable. And if you have that by virtue of your conduct and whatever it is, then you have a precious thing, which is not to be lightly esteemed. So that's fine. But then he says something that doesn't seem to fit with it at all, doesn't he? And the day of death is better than the day of one's birth. What on earth does that have to do with a good name being better than precious ointment? Doesn't seem to have a lot to do with it at all, does it? And now this is one of the preacher's favorite techniques. He says something that seems to be true and right, and then he says something else which jars in some way. Sometimes it contradicts or stands in tension, is the polite way of saying that. And sometimes it just jars or doesn't seem to fit well. And the preacher is always collecting things like this that don't seem to fit well. So he has this concept of judgment, and yet he notices that death happens to all, to those who have done good works and to those who have done evil works. And this is going to happen all the time. I just want to introduce that idea, and we'll take it. We'll be taking it further, hopefully tomorrow. It's a deliberate part of his strategy. Now, what then is the connection between a good name is better than precious ointment and the day of death is better than one's birth? Well, it takes a long time to build a good reputation. You know, no one can build a good reputation, to get a good name in 2 minutes, can they? It takes years, usually, of work and effort so that people can come to see that you are consistent, that you are faithful, that you are systematically such a way, and they didn't just happen to get you at a freak moment of goodness. And it's that consistency where you build one thing on top of another and you keep building over a period of time that people then know that they can trust you and that you are reliable, that you are faithful, and that your good name is built. Now, if it takes a long time to build a good name, how long does it take to destroy one? Now, that can be done in 2 minutes, can't it? It can be done a lot quicker than that. Now, why is that? You know, why is it that imbalance? Why does it take so long to build that thing and then and can be torn down so quickly? That doesn't seem right. That seems an absurdity, doesn't it? You know, it's like climbing this huge hill and then you just plummet to the bottom. Why is it like that? Isn't that a vanity? Well, and there's only one way that you can lock in your good name. And do you know what that is? It's to die, isn't it? And, you know, so there's this debate about who was the greatest Beatle. Was it John Lennon or Paul McCartney? Now, you might have your view on that. You know, if you like melody, maybe you'll say it's Paul. And, you know, if you like clever lyrics, you might say it's John. And but the fact that John Lennon died and that Paul McCartney is still alive is actually quite a big point in favor of more people thinking that it's John rather than Paul, isn't it? You lock it in, don't you? It's like people retiring at the peak of their game, isn't it? After some, you know, incredible record-breaking run of goals or strikes or something, and then just stopping there instead of, you know, having this slow decline where you gradually go from the top division to the next division, and then you're sort of playing in the league at your local town and nobody cares anymore. And that's the connection then. And you see how ironic it is. It's like, well, it's great to get your good name, but, you know, then you better die quick. And then you'll be okay. And then, of course, what use is your good name to you then? It's of no use at all, and it's going to be soon forgotten, which is something that he's going to point out elsewhere in the book. So maybe it's better to be dead. Well, let's have a look at chapter 4, and there's more along those lines. So I returned and considered all the oppressions that I'd done under the sun. And behold, the tears of such as were oppressed, and they had no comforter. And on the side of their oppressors there was power, but they had no comforter. So this is another part of his investigation then. He goes and considers all the examples of oppression, of injustice, of exploitation, that he can find in the world. How long do you think that took him? That must have been a pretty lengthy investigation, wouldn't it? The world is full of that stuff. And, you know, it's amazing, isn't it, that people should really believe that, you know, that we can heal ourselves, that it's getting better, you know, because we know when we go out there into different parts of the world, that oppression and that cruelty and that injustice is just as alive today in the world as it always was. The world is full of it, and you can feel him sort of sinking down under the weight of considering it. I mean, it's bad enough just to know of one or two examples and to really think what it must be like for those people who have suffered some of the terrible things that are done in this world. But you know, to imagine taking on all the sufferings, and you know, this then helps you think about Christ taking on the burden of our sins, doesn't it? And of God having to watch day after day after day and stand back when he could intervene, and allowing us to have that free will to do all those evil things to one another. What kind of forbearance that must involve on his part. And Solomon now then does this intense investigation of this, and you can imagine how that makes him feel. It makes him feel like this: wherefore I praise the dead which are already dead more than the living which are yet alive. Yea, better is he than both which hath not yet been, which hath not seen the evil work that is done under the sun. So at least when you're dead, you're not aware of all that stuff anymore. And you know, you have to forget about it, don't you? You have to not think about it. Or how could you carry on in life? How could you carry on living? It's just too bad, isn't it? And so he's saying, at least when you're dead, that's over. I remember a brother once giving an exhortation about that. Actually, Brother Andrew Perry in the Sunderland Ecclesia, which I used to belong to. And he was saying, you know, if you're really conscious of the presence of sin in your life and the awfulness of it and the and how offensive it is to God, then that is one reason why you can, in a sense, look forward to death or see it as being a positive thing. And that's why we're baptized, isn't it? You know, that we die to it. But I thought it was an interesting, you know, I would never have I would never have put it like that, and I'm not sure I would put it like that myself even now. But it's a very thought-provoking thing that he said. You know, we say all the time that we're sinners, but we don't always feel it, do we? Sometimes it can just be words that come out of our mouths, and we sort of carry on as if, well, we're pretty good, really. And his point is at least when death comes, that struggling with sin, that constant battle, that constant awareness of how you've fallen short is gone. And that is itself a relief. And all there is then, and of course we're not looking forward to it then because we're dead, but all the next thing that there is then is the blessed relief from it, isn't it? When our bodies are redeemed by God's grace and we're permitted to enter into his glory. And what Solomon is saying is here is, you know, when you're dead, you're not aware of all of that evil in the world anymore. And you know, in a way, it's better never to have seen it. Just imagine if you'd never had to know that human beings were so bad. That would be kind of nice. But it is what it is. We are what we are, and the sooner we face up to it, the quicker we can do something about it and redirect our lives. Now, just while we're here, it might just be worth noticing the next verse of chapter 4, because this is just another one of those examples of how he juxtaposes things against one another. Again, I considered all travail and every right work. And you think, well, great. You know, it's good to consider work and industry. Work and industry are good things, and especially right works, especially good works. What a positive thing to think about. But notice the second half of his phrase, that for this a man is envied of his neighbor. This also is vanity and vexation of spirit. So you do something good, and what happens? You create an evil out of it because someone's jealous or envious of you because you did something good. And isn't that just typical, you know? The point is that everywhere he turns, he sees this kind of thing, this kind of irony. This. As soon as you try to build something positive, it's like there's an equal and opposite negative to set against it, so that at the end there is no profit. You know, the balance sheet balances with nothing. Nothing left over. There's no profit. Do you remember how we were talking about that yesterday? There's nothing that extends beyond when you look at life here as an end in itself. And one of the things we talked about was all that huge literature, all those books that had been written about Ecclesiastes over the past centuries and millennia. And I mentioned that one of the main things that happens in those books is that people try to reconcile these contradictions in the book. And I think by doing that, it completely misses the point. The point is the contradiction. The point is that things don't fit. The point is that things are not meant to fit, because God has made the creation subject to vanity. Now that's a really important point. Now even if you don't accept that, even if you think that, you know, you can reconcile all the contradictions in Ecclesiastes, and some people do, you know, some people have written really fat books to do that, and, you know, like hundreds of years ago, a rabbi came up with, these are, you know, four principles, which if you follow these four principles, you'll be able to reconcile every contradiction in Ecclesiastes. It's a bit like the seven habits, you know, the seven habits of highly effective Ecclesiastes interpreters. You know, if you follow these 7 points, you'll be able to reconcile it all. And then some other rabbi came along and said, well, actually, you need 8 points, and if you take my extra points, then you can do it. And then the liturgy goes on and on like that. But even if you believe you can reconcile them all, then the question still remains, why should they be there in the first place to need reconciling? So you've got to explain why, you know, so it's like there's these stumbling blocks. You keep tripping up as you read the book, and so you need one of these rabbis to come along and help you straighten it all out. The question is, why did the preacher put all the stumbling blocks in the first place to need the rabbi to straighten them out for you? You need an answer to that question, don't you? Generally, people haven't asked that question. Why are the stumbling blocks there in the first place? But the key to it, and this isn't my idea, this is the person who's put this most thoroughly, I think, as far as I'm aware, is this guy Fox that I've mentioned a couple of times. The contradictions, the discontinuities, the ambiguities, the things that don't fit, the things in tension are the very point. That to every positive there is a negative, that to everything that you say there's an "ah, but." So that there can be no profit under the sun. So that we are left being but beasts unless God redeems us from that fate. So that we're hedged in by these things in life that don't make sense. And it's only God who can reach in and lift us out from that and give us this hope and this purpose of something better. Let's then, we're going to talk a bit more about that, I think tomorrow. But that's perhaps a good introduction to the subject of contradictions. But let's go now to our final passage for today, which is the one in chapter 12. So yesterday we considered the first poem inside the frame, the one about the cycles of nature and so on, and this now is the last inside the frame, and this too is about death. Remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth, while the evil days come not, nor the years draw nigh, when thou shalt say, I have no pleasure in them. While the sun, or the light, or the moon, or the stars be not darkened, nor the clouds return after rain. So the time is coming, then, for each of us, as our lives head to their conclusion. So let's imagine we're a typical person who lives out a normal lifespan and is going to, is going to suffer a typical experience of the effects of aging. Or as decrepitude is a word. Brother Ron was telling me about that word yesterday. He has it as the heading in this part of his Bible. Impending decrepitude. It's a great prospect. So the time is coming then when the sun and the light will darken for us, for every human being, as they approach their death, this cloudy time. And he goes on then in verse 3 to verse 5 to describe some of the facets of that. In the day when the keepers of the house shall tremble, and the strong men shall bow themselves, and the grinders cease, because they are few, and those that look out of the windows be darkened, and the doors shall be shut in the streets, when the sound of the grinding is low. And he shall rise up at the voice of the bird, and all the daughters of music shall be brought low. Also, when they shall be afraid of that which is high, and fear shall be in the way, And the almond tree shall flourish, and the grasshopper shall be a burden, and desire shall fail, because man goeth to his long home, and the mourners go about the streets. Now, I'm sure you know that that is usually taken as a poem about the aging process, about impending decrepitude. And it's normally taken as an allegory. So the individual things that are mentioned there are taken to be symbols of things to do with a human body as it deteriorates, as old age marches on. So, for example, to remind you for those that know this, and I didn't know it for quite a while actually. I think I was I don't know whether I was in my late 20s or something until I came across this. But when you first see it, it's quite amazing, isn't it? How the different parts of the body are looked at here. So it talks about the keepers of the house trembling. And people think of that as being the arms, the weakening arms, and the beginning of trembling that can take place there. No longer the firm grip and the ability to do things with the arms that was once there. The strong men shall bow themselves. The weakening back and bowing legs, the stoop, which often accompanies aging. The grinders shall cease, because they are few. Tooth decay and loss. The windows are darkened, failing eyesight. The doors are shut in the streets, like as if the noise from the streets isn't coming through anymore, and the hearing is no longer as acute as it used to be. The sound of the grinding is low, a weakening voice, perhaps, or more difficulties with eating. Rising up at the voice of the bird. Light sleep, terminated sleep, getting up in the middle of the night, waking up in the morning and not being able to go back to sleep again. Nervousness, perhaps. And then there are some other more literal ones, aren't there, like fear of heights and so forth that are mentioned in there as well. So that's the conventional interpretation of the passage, which imagines a human body and looks at the ways the various parts of it. And obviously it's different things for different people. We don't all go through that same experience in which every part deteriorates the same way, do we? It's a little bit different for each of us, and some of us are blessed to keep most of our faculties strong until the end of our days or until close to the end of the days. But generally, This is a typical human experience, that these are the things that will begin to weaken. This is the sad end to, you remember the chap walking across the stage there and saying, look how great I am. This is the sad end to which that person is going as he approaches his death. And there is that death in verse 7. Then shall the dust return to the earth as it was. Now that's a complete undoing of Genesis 2, isn't it? In which God formed man out of the dust of the ground. Here then again is Ecclesiastes as a commentary on Genesis. And that now, that creation of man being reversed into his uncreation as he's taken down by God and returns to the dust, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. And you can see two metaphors for death, or for life and death, being used there in verse 6. Or ever the silver cord be loosed, or the golden bowl be broken, or the pitcher be broken at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the cistern. So there's two images there. One is the image of a golden bowl on a silver cord. And this is probably a light. And you can imagine the light sitting in the golden bowl and hanging from this silver cord. And eventually the time comes and it's the cord breaks and the bowl smashes to the ground and smashes. And the oil is dispersed and the light is extinguished. There's nothing to contain that life, that light of life anymore. And the light and the life is extinguished. And the other metaphor is this idea of the pitcher being broken at the fountain and the wheel at the cistern. And this is a well then, isn't it? And you've got the pitcher that's normally let down into the well and it pulls up the water, and of course water is a common, you know, or a natural symbol for life, isn't it? And the water of life is drawn up, and you know, we survive by drinking that water. And then the wheel that lets down the pulley and the cord is broken. And the bucket, the pitcher, falls down into the well and you can't reach to get it back out again. And no more water is coming up. And that's death. And that's where it ends. It ends with that quote of Genesis. This is how God has hemmed us in. This is death as the great leveler. So that's one way of looking at Ecclesiastes 12. But there are two others that are much less common. Commonly talked about, but that are also interesting. You know, I think we got it right when we talked about what we just talked about the weakening human body, but there are probably other dimensions in this passage as well. And one of them is to say, well, it's all very well cashing in what are the keepers of the house and what are the strong men and saying they represent something, but suppose we stop before we cash out these things and say, well, what's actually being described? What is the scene that's being described that we're taking as an allegory? And the idea here is that the scene being described is literally a funeral procession. And so the sound of grinding is low, and the windows are darkened in the streets. And the children are not playing in the streets because someone has died in the village. And the funeral procession is coming through. And even the strong men now are standing in respect. And the silence, there's no activity. Everyone is somber and struck by the solemnity of the occasion as this funeral procession passes through, and the only thing that's making any noise is the natural creation, the birds and the grasshoppers and so forth. They're going on regardless, aren't they? And all human beings now are silenced, thinking about the somberness of this. But the animals are still, you know, the crickets are still chirping in the fields. And so the other aspects of creation, the natural creation, are mocking in a way what the human beings are going through. And that was just what we saw in chapter 1, wasn't it? Do you remember how the cycles, the perpetual cycles, were mocking the shortness of our days as we only passed across that stage the one time? And just as those things went round and round and round and they went and they came, so now death is coming to this person. The person is going somewhere. They're returning. They're returning to their place. And that's the power of the end of verse 5. Because a man goeth to his long home, to his eternal home, and the mourners go about the streets. So now there's a literal dimension to that. If you imagine this passage is describing a funeral procession, and you imagine the dead man in the procession going to his eternal home, going to his grave, that's literally true, isn't it? A man is going to his long home, and the mourners are going about the streets. So the passage works at that level too, which is very interesting. And you say, well, whose funeral is it? And in a way, we're all watching our own funeral, aren't we? And this is Psalm 90 from a different perspective. So teach us to number our days. One final level of meaning I'd like to talk about in this chapter 12. There are some parallels between this passage and some prophetic passages that describe God's judgments upon his nation or nations or other nations and the sort of end time. We'll just take one as an example of that. Would you just come with me to Jeremiah 4? You might want to just keep a marker in Ecclesiastes. Now you remember that Ecclesiastes 12 began by it getting dark, didn't it? And darkness and the clouds, the threatening, ominous clouds gathering, you know, that's often a symbol, an end time symbol. And you can see Jeremiah here mourning in verse 19, my bowels, I am pained at my very heart. My heart maketh a noise in me. I cannot hold my peace. Because thou hast heard, O my soul, the sound of the trumpet and the alarm of war. This sense that the judgment is coming, this sense of impending doom. Destruction upon destruction is cried. Verse 22. For my people is foolish, they have not known me. They are sottish children, and they have none understanding. Verse 23, and now we really get into it. I beheld the earth, and lo, it was without form and void, and the heavens, and they had no light. I beheld the mountains, and lo, they trembled, and all the hills moved lightly. I beheld, and lo, there was no man, and all the birds of the heaven were fled. I beheld, and lo, the fruitful place was a wilderness, and all the cities thereof were broken down at the presence of the Lord, and by his fierce anger. For thus hath the Lord said, the whole land shall be desolate, yet will I not make a full end. For this shall the earth mourn, and the heavens above be black, because I have spoken it, I have purposed it. I will not repent, neither will I turn back from it. The whole city shall flee for the noise of the horsemen and bowmen. And so the passage goes on. But if you do a series of links there between the two passages, there are a surprising number. And they're not all working in exactly the same way, but it seems to me that there are enough points of connection between this and other end-time passages or judgment of God passages upon his people or upon peoples in general to suggest that there may even be a wider way of interpreting Ecclesiastes 12, that the mourning is not just for a man that dies, but is in a way for the whole human experience that is passing away. The end of this age. It's that's going to its long home. And we know that that's true, don't we? We know that this world is passing away. And if you didn't have the hope that we have, it would be a sad thing indeed, wouldn't it? It would be a thing to mourn. That, you know, couldn't we have done any better than that? Couldn't have there been a better ending than that human society as we know it should go to its long home? But it has to be that way because man cannot redeem himself. And only God can do that. And only God can set up a kingdom which shall not be moved. And it's only when we trust him to do it rather than thinking that we can do it ourselves in human societies that we are going to get any place other than that eternal home that God decreed when he fixed that boundary. But the message of Ecclesiastes 12 is not a negative message. And that's remarkable, isn't it? You know, the message of Psalm 90 was not a negative message. So teach us to number our days that we might apply our hearts to wisdom. So too the message of Ecclesiastes is actually the exhortational point is a very positive one. Remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth. While we still have opportunity, whether we're young or not, we still have at least some faculties left, or else we couldn't be here, could we? We have some opportunity left to us to remember our Creator and to make him and his work and not ourselves and our own work the focus of our lives. And when we consider our fate and our eternal home, as we have from passages like Ecclesiastes 12, what else is there for us to do but that we should give to God the best of the rest of our lives?